This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
From the Book of Serenity, Case 56, Spiritual Uncle Me and the Rabbit, the Pointer. Better to be sunk forever than to seek the liberation of the saints. Devadatta experienced the bliss of the third meditation heaven while in uninterrupted hell. Udraka Ramaputra fell from the heaven of the summit of existence into the body of a flying wildcat. Tell me, where is the gain and loss? The main case. As Master Dongshan and his spiritual uncle Mi were walking along, they saw a white rabbit run by in front of them. Mi said, "Swift." Dongshan said, "How? In what way?" Mi said, "It's like a commoner being made a prime minister." Dongshan said, "Such a venerable old person, and still you say such things." Uncle Mi said, "Then what about you?" And Dongshan said, "Generations of nobility temporarily fallen into poverty." Verse. Matching strength with snow and frost, walking evenly through clouds and sleet, Zhao Hui left the country. Zhang Gru crossed the bridge. Zhao and Cao's strategy was able to establish the Han. Chao and Zhu wanted to avoid Yao completely. Favor and disgrace are disturbing. Profoundly trust in yourself. In the real state, one mixes tracks with fishermen and woodcutters. This koan is a good example, the pointer in particular, of how the teachings, in a sense, are always creating disruption, startling us, shaking us out of our slumber until they don't anymore. Until we hear them not as startling or strange, but as clear and simple. Devadatta, as you know, was a relative of the Buddha who at a certain point came to the Buddha and said, "Thank you very much," in so many words. Said, "Thank you very much, old man. You've done a great deal. Now it's time to step down and let the next generation take your place." And the Buddha said, "Not yet." And then Devadatta, who had some malice in his heart, went on to work against the Buddha, physically trying to hurt him, at one point walking away with, because he was a very powerful person. And he had a powerful role within the Sangha, and he walked away with a considerable portion of the Sangha who were sort of wooed by him. And the Buddha sent some of his senior disciples to speak with those students, and I think many of them ended up returning. But so he, within the early history of Buddhism, is sort of a figure of somebody who ran away with himself and his ignorance and his still yet undeveloped understanding. But here, the pointer says that he experienced the bliss of the third meditation heaven while in an uninterrupted hell because of his actions. So how is that? And Ramaputra was one of the early teachers of the Buddha before he came to enlightenment, for whom the Buddha had quite a lot of respect. In fact, after the Buddha's enlightenment, he wanted to go back to him and offer his wisdom, because he thought this old teacher of his would be receptive, but he had already died. And so here's this highly developed person. The pointer says he fell from heaven, the summit of existence, in the body of a flying wildcat, which might sound like a good thing, but It's not. So what's going on? So in that way, the teachings are trying to upset our normal way of thinking about things. So we stop and have to question, what's going on here? Why? Within this religious teaching, within this pointing for our benefit towards our liberation, why would they speak this way? So there's falling into hell and there's dwelling in heaven. There's gain and there's loss. There's succeeding and failing. There's being true in our practice with the Dharma, and then there is forgetting and transgressing, causing harm. How do we hold all of this? In the commentary, there's a passage that says, in the teachings there are two gates, natural and cultivated. Usually we awaken by means of cultivation, entering enlightenment from ordinariness. A commoner is directly appointed prime minister. If you're first enlightened, though, and then cultivate afterwards, then you enter ordinariness from sagehood. Traditional nobility is originally honorable. Then he says, though drifting destitute in myriad conditions, the basic constitution is still there. That's why it's said in the metaphor of the destitute son, or the sometimes referred to as a prodigal child story of Buddhism in the Lotus Sutra, the path is clearly illustrated. So there is cultivation coming from samsara, cultivation that leads to awakening, entering into enlightenment from our ordinariness. And there is awakening that is then followed by cultivation. Some people come to realization, have realization insights without ever having practiced, sometimes knowing nothing about Buddhism. And then they practice entering into ordinariness from that enlightenment. And the pointer says, all the while, in all cases, the basic constitution is there. So this weekend is the July 4th weekend, the weekend that remembers marks the signing of the Declaration of Independence, the beginning of the sort of conscious revolution that began to create these United States. And the residents last night took the night off from sitting and watched Hamilton, which was great and a treat. And saying earlier to somebody that it's things like that that, I mean, there are many moments that remind me in a very deep way of the goodness that exists within us and our capacity. And when watching something like that, I think this is what we are. This is what we're made of. This is what we can do. Retelling a story that was originally inhabited by very few representatives of these United States and the citizens, and retold in a way that was in which many more were accounted for in the telling. And so here's a slight recasting of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all people, including all genders and skin tones, faiths, sexual orientations, bodies, economies, ages, that the great earth and all creatures, sentient and insentient, are unborn and undying in the great equality, each endowed with Buddha nature, having enlightened mind and virtues, arising and inseparable from emptiness, from which all life, all creation bursts forth in radiance and natural freedom. That all beings desire and so should be granted and encouraged to realize and actualize certain inalienable rights. Chief among these being life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, true liberty, unfettered life. That among these human creations, governments are instituted among the people, deriving their just powers from the fair and equitable consent of the governed, that is, of the people, by the people, for the people. And that whenever any form of government, institution, or human system becomes destructive of those ends, becomes diluted, it's the right of the people, it's the mandate, the imperative, to, in accord with their basic nature, alter, abolish, institute new governments, new institutions, laying their foundations on such principles and organizing their powers in such forms as to them, being in accord with reality, shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. All in order to form a more perfect union, a more united states, a more unified individuality, and to encourage the mutual well-being of this great Mother Earth and all of its beings. And for the support of this declaration, and with the firm reliance on the wisdom and compassion present within every human being, we mutually commit to each other our lives, our codependent deliberation, and our sacred dignity. If you're going to dream, dream big. What is the basic constitution from which life, liberation, and happiness comes forth? So Dongshan was a descendant of Master Matsu. And Uncle Mi was his, kind of more like his cousin. They both came from different lines, but tracing their way back to Matsu. But they were walking together and a rabbit ran by. Dongshan said, or Uncle Mi said, swift. Another translation says, elegant. And Dongshan said, what do you mean? What are you saying? And Uncle Mi said, it's like a commoner being made a prime minister. And the footnote to that says, it's easy to descend into the sky from the ground. Commoner being made a prime minister. Right? That's what we saw last night in the story of Alexander Hamilton. Somebody who came from very unfavorable conditions, who rose to a place of high power, of wealth. And Dongshan says, such a venerable old person still speaking this way. Uncle Mi says, well, how would you say it? Dongshan said, generations of nobility temporarily falling into poverty. And the footnote to that says, descending from the sky is hard. And so we saw that in the story of Hamilton. His descent, his crash from high was hard. But of course, here we're talking about a different ascent and a different return. These two gates, one coming from within samsara, practicing, realizing the illusions, realizing what is the nature of suffering. Why are we bound? How or what are we bound with, in, to? And then realizing that fundamental basic constitution, which is our nature, our Buddha nature, and then merging that, which is just a manner of speaking, because it's never divided, but merging that with our actions. learning how to be prime minister, learning how to manifest as Buddha. And then there's being within enlightenment. Having seen through that illusion and working towards harmonizing with ordinariness. So from the ordinary view that we all tend to bring in, something impure becomes pure. Something pure stays above the impurity, somehow stays outside. That's why the lotus is a symbol of enlightenment, because it's not outside of the muddy water. It grows from within the muddy water. So the rabbit runs by and Dongshan says, swift. So remember that all the teachings are always about bringing us closer. So if we think of this as a story about a rabbit and speed, then there's something essential that's not seen. So how do we gain the essential? Well, we have to come closer to the rabbit. Swift. What is that? The rabbit doesn't know right and wrong. The rabbit doesn't know fast or slow. It isn't cultivating ordinariness. It's not trying to seek enlightenment. The way Dongshan, or the way Uncle Mi expresses that is swift. We could say within the mind of the rabbit, there is no duality, there is no division, there is no sense of running or not running, there's just swift. Dogen speaks of this in his fascicle on suchness. He says, actualizing Buddha ancestors is reality, thoroughly experienced. Actualizing Buddha ancestors is reality thoroughly experienced. Right? Which in a way seems to be the way each of us wants to live our life. Thoroughly experienced. Right? None of us aspire. I'd like to live half of my life. I'd like to live half of what could be. I'd like to live my life unthoroughly experienced. Mildly experienced, half-heartedly experienced, right? Those are not on cards that we send to people, inspirational cards, right? Reality is all things, Dogen says. All things are reality, thusness. Swift. There is original nature, thusness. There is body, thusness. There's mind thusness, world thusness, cloud and rain thusness, walking, standing, sitting, lying down thusness, sadness, joy, emotion, stillness thusness, staff and whisk thusness, just to name a few. What he's saying is that in every moment, in every position, in every circumstances, in everything, there is reality thoroughly experienced. Because our mind divides, because we language, we have distinctly different experiences. To even be able to know half-heartedness, not thoroughly, to even be able to think of thoroughly, to be able to aspire to reality thoroughly experienced means we're already in the experience of something less than. Otherwise, we wouldn't have this language to speak of such a thing. Unborn and undying in the greater quality, endowed with Buddha nature, all creation bursts forth in radiance and natural freedom. So in that sense, governments, institutions, communities, anything we create from a Buddhist perspective, fundamentally should be created to express that radiance and natural freedom. That's its purpose. Its purpose, in a sense, is to mirror into the world that natural freedom that we already possess, and to affirm it, to support it, to strengthen it, to share it. A commoner made a prime minister. In one of the poems in the Woman Khan, it says, when an ordinary person sees it, they become a sage. And so we practice this to free and release our mind from complications. But then why does he challenge Uncle Mi in this way? Such a venerable person speaking this way. And then he responds, Dongshan responds, generations of nobility fallen into poverty. When a sage realizes it, they become an ordinary person. And that's just one way of dividing people, characteristics, qualities, skin color, sexual orientation, faiths, sizes, shapes, abilities. And because our senses do perceive those differences, which from a Buddhist perspective function to bring into our consciousness the glory, the radiance of those differences. But because of our insecurity, because of our self-grasping, because of greed, anger, and delusion, we imbue those differences with meaning. That's why in the poem he says, favor and disgrace are disturbing. We can understand how disgrace is disturbing, but why favor? Lao Tzu says, favor and disgrace are disturbing. When you get one, you're disturbed. When you lose one, you're disturbed. So when we're disgraced, it's disturbing. When we have favor, it's disturbing because we will lose it. And so there's fear and anxiety even in trying to hold on to it. So being low, we want to be high. Jealousy and resentment arises. When we're high, we want to be higher. We want to stay high, and so pride and arrogance appear, masking insecurity. You know, over the years, every once in a while, a student will quite honestly and courageously say, acknowledge that they are afraid, actually. They see themselves, their practice progressing. They see things transforming. Within their meditation, they see themselves getting to the edges of things where something more profound could come about, and they see themselves pulling back. And sometimes that's just kind of an habitual reactive response to hold, to maintain control, to not experience something different than before. But sometimes people will say that they realize they are afraid of realizing the self because then they won't have any excuses. Then they will really need to be responsible. And I say, no, that's already happened. You've already arrived at that place where you are responsible. We've already arrived at the place where we should start to lay to rest our excuses. And that even when you realize, you can still abdicate responsibility. We can still make excuses, but now we do it within an awareness that makes it much more painful. In the commentary, or in the poem, he refers to the story in the Lotus Sutra of the prodigal child. It's a different story, but there's enough similarity that it's compared. So there's a story in the Lotus Sutra of a child who was born to a wealthy family. And like children often are wont to do, this one goes wandering, leaves home, goes far away into distant lands, traveling further and further away. And as they travel year after year, finding their way, making things work as best they can, they get more and more destitute. Things aren't working out very well. And so they keep moving on, trying to start over and make it work better, but it just keeps, the cycle keeps happening, keeps being recreated, and so they just become more poor and more desperate. Having abandoned their home, the sutra says, they seek a place in another land. Bodhidharma's teachings, he says, in countless ages gone by have wandered and turned from the essential to the trivial and traveled through all manners of existences, often angry and guilty, causing harm and not understanding, not knowing why. Is it that in every person there is a story of leaving home, of going wandering, seeking, abandoning and seeking, leaving and then trying to return? This great separation, this isolation, this estrangement, this loneliness, this hunger to belong, the sense of distance and division, this breach. And so this child hurries, becomes more and more frantic, hurrying in every direction, further and further, until, it says, until by chance they turn their steps into the direction of their homeland. To me, that's one of the most, my favorite parts of the story. The simple words. All of this is happening, and then it's just this very simply, almost innocuously, you could pass it by and not even notice. Until by chance they turned. Do you see the momentousness of that moment? The whole earth turns in that moment. This person's on a path, they're on a trajectory, they've been heading in the same direction for so many years. And then suddenly, by chance, they turn? What? Maybe not quite by chance. Bodhicitta is not an accident. It's not something you can control, but it's not an accident. I mean, what does an accident mean? I mean, an accident is not an accident. An accident happens because of certain actions and circumstances. We can say it was unintentional. We can say we didn't mean to stop and suddenly turn in a direction. We didn't have a plan to do so. We may not even know that we were doing so. Maybe when this person turned their steps in the direction of their homeland, they didn't even know that's what they were doing. They didn't know that this was a new direction. I think very often, in fact, that's the case. Miraculous. It's almost like there's an internal compass that gets all kiltered, off-kiltered, right? And it's wobbly. Right? And so we're trying to follow it, but it's pointing in all these different directions. And so we kind of go wandering around. And then suddenly, boom, it finds north. In a sense, that's the most important moment right there. Because until that moment happens, the rest of the story is going to be a different story. It's going to be a different story. That's the moment. And in a sense, that has to happen over and over and over and over. And then suddenly we know what we're doing. We know that we're actually turning. And now we recognize, oh, I'm turning away. I'm wandering again. And I need to turn back. Now we know. before, likely not. You know, when I think back on my life, you know, it seemed like, you know, that koan, how do you walk straight on a path with 99 curves? Enough that, you know, at one point my grandfather sat me down and said, son, I'm a little concerned about you. Do you know where you're going? He actually said, you seem a lot like your father. And even at that age, I don't know, I was 18, 19. And we were not particularly close, so this was kind of an unusual conversation we were having, that he was taking that level of interest in me. And I said, I can't explain why, but I think I'm headed in a direction. I know I can't convince you of that right now because I'm not entirely sure myself, because I don't actually know how this story plays out. But I don't think I am just lost. And I think that capacity, you know, the capacity that we have to be clear and confused, to be lost and found, to be wandering and straight ahead at the same time, is wonderful. Because now when I look back at my life, it really does feel like zoop. Feels like a straight line. It did not feel like that in the midst. So this one, having turned by chance in the direction of home, starts making their way home, and finally, without knowing it, they come to the edge of town. And they see their parents' house. They see their parents. And gazing off from a far distance, they see this radiance, this illumination, this powerful person, their parent. And the sutra says they are filled with fear and awe and wonder, why did I ever come to this place? It says, when the impoverished child saw how great their parents' power and authority was, they were filled with fear and awe and regretted they had ever come here. Secretly, they thought to themselves, this must be some kind of king, some queen, some powerful lord. This is not the sort of place where I can make my way, where I can hire out my labor and gain a living. At this point, that's what they were looking for. They didn't even know what they were seeking, really. It says, it would be better if I just went to some poor village where if I work hard, I'll find a place and can earn food and living. I can stay there. That's where I should be, not here. This is not for someone like me. I'm just a commoner. The parents seeing this looks over and sees their child, recognizes them, just like that. It's been 20, 30, 40 years, recognizes them just like that. In the teachings it says it's like recognizing a face that you have known your whole life but have just simply forgotten. And so the parent sends a messenger to bring the child in. And so the messenger runs out to do their job, and they grab the child and says, come with me. He wants to see you. And the child freaks out. It's like, no, it's not me. I didn't do it. You've got the wrong person. That's not me. It's like listening to the teachings and thinking, these aren't for me. You're not talking about me. And so there's such a freak out that the child faints to escape, to get out of it. And so the parent sees this, calls the messenger back, says, come back. This is not working. This is not skillful. And it says, because the parent knew that the child was of humble outlook and ambition, and that the parent's own abundance would be difficult for the child to accept, they knew that as a form of expedient means, they had to find another way, another entry. And so they send another messenger and just offer the child some work in a barn, cleaning the horse shit, right? Cleaning the stables. And the child says, yeah, I can do that. That's good. Honorable work, right? Necessary work. It must be done. And so, child goes to work, works hard, diligent, careful, conscientious, taking responsibility. The parent sees this and gives more responsibility. In the beginning, goes to visit the child just because they want to be close to them. But no, if they go in their finery, if they go dressed like a Buddha, child's, you know, going to clam up. And so the parent puts on dirty clothes and puts mud on their face and goes and talks in a gruff voice. But year after year, the child is very conscientious and diligent and develops themselves, does good work, and so the parent keeps giving more and more responsibility. Brings them in closer. Until the child themselves, as the sutra says, felt that they were understood and trusted, that they were seen, and could now come and go at ease, although even, they still continued to live in the same place. Till finally the parent perceives the child as bit by bit becoming more self-assured and magnanimous in their outlook. Right? How they were relating to other people, how they were relating to themselves. And as they developed, began to aspire for greater things, began to allow for the possibility to have confidence that more was possible, and was released from their formerly low opinion of themselves. This is a very old sutra, right? Maybe things haven't changed so much. And finally, the parent comes to the child and says, from now on, you and I will no longer act as two people. We will act as one. The commoner and the prime minister. The student and the teacher. The ordinary person and the Buddha. From now on, we'll no longer act as two. We will act as one. It's time. And then finally, the parent calls everybody together and announces, reveals the true identity of the parent, of the child. That happens the moment somebody encounters the Dharma. That's what the teachings are doing, is from the very beginning, revealing our true identity. The sutra says that hearing this, the child was joyful and buoyant and said, I originally had no faith or confidence to aspire to this place, and yet now these treasures have come of their own accord since the beginning and with some effort. Actualizing Buddha ancestors is reality thoroughly experienced. All things are reality, thusness. And so at every step along the way, we talked about this yesterday in our retreat, at every step along the way as we're liberating ourselves from obstacles and encountering obstacles, they were trying to open up our heart to compassion, and we're experiencing anger, frustration, judgment, hatred. that we aspire to that prime minister, we experience ourselves in that ordinary place. How do we not set one against the other? How do we no longer live as two? In the Zen tradition, that's where we begin. Direct pointing to the human mind. That the beginning and the middle and the end of the path begins now. But as we practice, we forget, we act out of our habits, we hurt ourselves, we hurt other people. Sometimes it's enough just to know, just to take responsibility. Examine, study, recommit, realign, renew our vows. Sometimes we need help. Sometimes we have to reach out. Sometimes we need to repair with others. And sometimes we see when those actions become destructive of these, of their ends, that is our aspiration, we must do something more significant, like going all the way to the root. Not just change our behavior, not just be aware of our thoughts and our words, not just rely on atonement and forgiveness, but go all the way down to the root. James Baldwin said, "I imagine that one of the reasons people cling to their hatred so stubbornly is because they sense that once that hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with the pain." How true that is. And of course, hatred here means every kind of dis-ease. Why do we cling to it so tenaciously? Why do people cling to power, to habits, to identities, to views so tenaciously? Because once we let them go, a gap opens. A gap is revealed that those views, all of those clingings have been filling and occupying us with. And in that gap is pain. Deep pain, historical, existential pain. The pain of our ancestors, the pain of our human ancestry, just the pain of knowing we are alive and it doesn't last forever. The pain of knowing we cannot control so much. You know, we were talking yesterday about how, or the other day, some of us were talking about getting older. And we were sort of, because we were, there's a group of elders, a little older, and we were talking about how, you know, when we were young, it's like I used to imagine getting older. You know, I'd see an older person, you know, and I would see them, you know, walking like an older person or, you know, getting up or down like an older person. And I would think, what's with that? You know? Why are you doing that like an old person? Why don't you just get up? Right? Like I do. You know? And I thought, well, when I get old, I'm just going to walk like this. I'm going to get up and down like I do now. Why not? Right? And when I die, it's going to be okay because I'm going to die. You know, it's going to end, but it's going to end like this. Right? I mean, this, like, talk about fantasies. This idea that I could, that this present experience was permanent and I would just get wrinkly. Right? Like something, you know, would change on the outside. I'd get old, but on the inside, it's just, I'm still me, right? That's not going to change, is it? You know, I mean, it's ridiculous, right? But at that time, that was the limit of my view, right? I couldn't identify, it was not a known experience for me. Therefore, it kind of didn't exist. And I put my, this doesn't exist, on to all of the evidence that was coming in. Oh, maybe for you, but not for me. But I think what Baldwin is saying, you know, if we can really appreciate that and find, we need to find ways in to ourselves and to others and understand the expressions that flow out of that pain. Because there are many, and many of them are hard. They're painful, they're violent, they're ugly. The expressions of that basic pain that somebody just does not want to feel. I get that, right? You get that. But to look beyond the expression, not to ignore it, not to excuse it in that sense. Everyone needs to take responsibility. And sometimes we need to be made to take responsibility as much as we can be. But to see beyond that, that's how compassion arises. That's how we gain patience. That's how we can develop the love of the bodhisattva, which is not based in the actions. I don't love your actions. But there is a person, there is a being, there is a creation that has a sacred dignity, and that has been lost. Right? You have wandered far, far from your homeland. And perhaps you have not yet stopped and turned back in that direction. I understand that too. I understand that. And I understand the fear of turning in that direction, because now what happens? Now what does this mean once I actually own up, start owning up? Am I ready to take that on? If I'm asking that question, it's too late. Favor and disgrace are hard to hold. Profoundly trust in yourself. Profoundly trust in yourself. You could make that a mantra. Something to keep close to home. And examine that. Profoundly trust in yourself. Again, James Baldwin. Love takes off the masks we fear, we cannot live without, and know that we cannot live within. We fear we cannot take them off, but we fear we cannot live within them. Exactly. Another way of saying that is standing on a precipice, 1,000 feet fall below, and standing behind you is an iron mountain. You can't go back, and you can't seem to go forward. You can't live with it, you can't live without it. At that moment, when we recognize that, there is that turning in the direction of home. And that's why we have to have courage. We have to bring forth true bravery. True bravery. Love takes off the masks we fear we cannot live without, and we know we cannot live within. And right there is the threshold of our awakening.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.